This podcast is from the IDPF Digital Book 2012 Conference at Book Expo America.
It says on the schedule that you're going to see both Len Vlahos and Angela Bowl of BISG, but Len's going to cover it by himself, so Angela's not here. And I'd like to present Len Vlahos, the Executive Director of BISG, the Book Industry Study Group.
Thanks, Leslie. Good morning, everybody. How are you? Good. So when Bill and Angela does send apologies, as the case is with BEA, we all tend to get overbooked, and that's just what happened with both of us. When Bill invited us to do this, it was really just to talk about really how does BISG or what does BISG do that impacts your world, and what is it that we're doing that can be of value to you, and how can you be of value to BISG? So this is going to be a little bit of a tour of BISG with hopefully some valuable takeaways. We're going to try and not make this a commercial. That's not the point. There will be one or two overt calls to action, but basically this is really what it is that BISG does. So let's talk first, and stop me with questions as we go. So first, BISG's mission statement is to create a more informed, empowered, and efficient book industry. And to us, that does mean helping to get friction out of the supply chain where it exists. So what are the various places where there's friction in the supply chain? And we'll go through that in detail and how we do it. What's interesting about BISG is that we are really the entity that has the broadest portfolio in the industry. Much like IDPF, which represents a real wide diversity of companies, BISG represents the full book industry supply chain. So we have publishers and printers. We have digital companies, retailers, wholesalers, libraries, the Authors Guild, agents. Everybody really participates in BISG. And it's really where people of competing interests but good intentions come together to solve problems. So we are a kind of a United Nations or Switzerland. And none of this happens without the active participation of the industry stakeholders. We are really driven by volunteers. We do have a four-person staff, but we're really driven by volunteers, which will lead me to my one overt thing today, which is a call to action, in that BISG does want everybody to be engaged. So as we discuss various issues, like EPUB, we want the widest possible diversity of voices discussing those issues. And that's really what we're after. So BISG does this through three main areas of endeavor. It's our little virtuous circle here. I'm going to go through each one of these, give you some highlights of what we do from each one, and then again, be happy to answer questions. So we'll start with research. Really what we need to know is to understand the industry that really drives a lot of what we do. And I'll talk about a couple of our research projects and then how some of those are impacting the other work that we do. I think by now most people know that we publish Bookstats in a joint venture with AAP. Bookstats is a method of understanding the size and scope of the U.S. book industry. What you're seeing here is data from the last Bookstats study. I'll talk about that in a second. We did it last year for the very first time, and we collected data for 2008, 2009, 2010, and we looked at that data along three different axes, channel, category, and format. We called it our cube, and I'm still not sure why, because I thought a cube had six sides. But it is kind of like our fake Hollywood cube that you can only see from the front. What we do then is we take the source data, right? So last year we collected about $15 billion in source data. And then there's a methodology by where we match that against all of the ISBNs known to be in print, extrapolate an average revenue per ISBN based on tiering publishers into different peer groups, and come up with the entire size of the industry. And again, I'm going to get to 2011 in a minute, but if you know, don't say, what do you think the size in terms of, and this is publisher net sales into the trade, not POS, publisher net sales into the trade. What do you think all formats, all channels, all categories, total size of the industry was at the end of 2010? Take a stab. Nobody? Not one guess? I'm going to just stand here. $20 billion. It's not bad, actually. It's about $28 billion. Okay, and that's trade, higher ed, LHI, professional scholarly. It's the entire size of the industry. And that was on about 2.5 billion or 2.6 billion units. And then when you look at the market, what we see is that on the left, the shaded areas in blue, adult fiction, adult nonfiction, juvenile, and religion, account for about half of the revenue. And on the right, about 80% of the units. And that's because of the higher average net unit price of textbooks and college textbooks, kids' textbooks. So trade is about half of the dollars and 80% of the units. But these are numbers from 2010. What about 2011? Well, we're going to wait. And actually what we're going to do is in room 1E11 this afternoon, we're going to give a preview of the methodology in Bookstats 2012 for 2011 data, as well as some new features. And the actual numbers are going to come out a couple of weeks after that. So we're looking sort of a early to mid-summer release of all of the 2011 data. And if you're interested, you're going to see a much deeper dive this year than last year, and you'll see it in this room here. And all of this research, by the way, really informs the rest of what we do, which I'll get to in a little bit. And when we think about removing friction from the industry, the first thing we have to do is understand it. So let me just ask quickly, who was just in the session I ran across the hall from? You're going to see a couple of things repeated. I apologize to you three people. So, but that's only just a couple of minutes here. We have three main what we call consumer studies. One is consumer attitudes toward e-book reading, which is exactly what it sounds like. One is student attitudes toward content in higher education. That's exactly what that sounds like. And one is faculty attitudes toward content in higher education, which has nothing to do with faculty attitudes. I'm kidding. It's exactly what it sounds like. And what I'll do is just tease out a couple of data points from these studies just so you can get a sense and a flavor of what these studies are like and how they can be useful. Starting with consumer attitudes. So one of the things, and there were a lot of unexpected results in the last couple of editions of Consumer Attitudes. This study is comprised of a representative sample of U.S. Citizens matched against the census data. We start with about 50,000 people and get down to about a panel of 1,500. It's a representative sample. These are people who have acquired an ebook, at least one ebook, in the last 18 months. And some of the things that we've seen in the recent studies, we all know that there was an explosion of ebooks right here, holiday 2010 into January 2011. But then we were surprised to see that it flattened out. Okay, and we're seeing some other data in the study that also shows what we were just talking about in the last session is not a mature market, but it's a maturing market in the U.S. Okay, as Kelly Gallagher in the last session said, you know, if the iPad is 2 years old and the Kindle is 5 years old, if you're a parent of a 2 or a 5 year old, you know that you would not use the word mature. However, the market is maturing. For example, one of the things we ask consumers in this study is whether or not they're increasing or decreasing their overall spending on books of all formats, E or P. And what you see, the blue bar is those saying that they're increasing, the red saying they're decreasing, but the gap has been narrowing. The next one we're going to publish in a couple of months will show that the gap narrows further to just about within the margin of error. Just about within the margin of error. We look at device preferences, and what we have seen is continued dominant strength from the Amazon Kindle e-reader as a device. This surprised us. We expected by the holidays of 2011 to really see tablets start to overtake that, and we didn't see that. But what we saw in the recent study was that Android-based tablets, and this is largely fueled by the BNN Nook and the Kindle Fire, are starting to make inroads. The consumers who are using this as their e-book reading device of choice is starting to grow. And that's the first time that we've seen that. That's new for us. We also track their activities by device. And you can see here that those who are doing those small format tablets, the Nook and the Fire, they're used primarily as e-readers. Primarily as e-readers, which makes sense with this, right? Those who are using other kinds of tablets, not so much. And this is among a universe of people who identify themselves as e-readers. They've acquired at least one e-book in the last 18 months. So these are people who are identifying themselves as e-readers, and they have these other devices, but they're not necessarily using them for e-reading. And it's probably the last time I show this chart or this slide, but this leads us to maybe a new problem for the book industry. When we talk about research, it's to uncover data, and data is to help us to identify issues that we can deal with. So if we think about a flattening market, a narrowing gap of those who say they're spending more or less on overall book purchases, people who are getting devices and not using them for reading. And by the way, the universe of people who have devices in the general population who, when you ask them how do they use the device, reading books is way down the list. And the number one thing that they give up time for to do something else is reading a book. So we call it the Angry Birds problem, right? It's that leisure time that we have given ourselves the ability to do so many different things at our fingertips with disposable leisure time really, really quickly. So this is the data is really pointing to that this is an issue, is that people are going to be reading less as they have quicker, easier forms of entertainment now at their fingertips and in their pocket and in their briefcase. And it's something that the industry needs to pay attention to. So that's just some highlights from consumer attitudes. And how we address that obviously remains to be seen. But understanding it is the first step in the process, which is why research is so incredibly important. The other two studies, faculty attitudes and student attitudes, we've also seen some interesting data here. For student attitudes, it's a representative panel of college students from across the country in both four-year colleges, two-year colleges, grad schools. And it's representative from, I believe it's Department of Education data that it's representative. And then it's a representative sample of faculty from across the country, though it's important to note it's not the same faculty and students in terms of courses and schools. They're two different studies. We ask the same questions, but they don't necessarily align where we're asking the questions or what the courses are. But they're representative, and the answers, I think, can be telling. So some of the things, just very, very top-line highlights that we learned from this. This is not surprising. As we've gone through the different fieldings of this study, and I should just pause and say we have done two volumes now of student attitudes and three volumes of consumer attitudes. As we look at the study here, we see that purchase habits have changed or are changing very significantly among students where they're acquiring their textbooks. And this is textbooks of any format, right? So they're migrating to an online purchase from a campus store purchase. Integrated learning systems, Wiley Plus, the Cengage Brain, educational tools like that are being adopted more and more widely, and the student satisfaction level is much, much higher than it has been. It's the same of faculty as well, although faculty has been lagging behind students. And that's really important for higher ed publishers to understand, is that faculty is really the target market to help them understand the value of these integrated learning systems. In terms of faculty plans to go digital, a lot of them are planning to go in that direction, though not as quickly as you would think. And it's not just books. It's not just publisher-created materials, or I should say publisher-created textbooks or digital course materials, but websites, web-based materials as well, to integrate them more into the classroom. And then lastly on this, before we dive into some of the real meat of what BISG does in terms of standards and the best practices, is I just found this a really interesting piece of data, and not surprising again, that students have migrated from basic cell phones to smartphones very, very quickly, like the rest of the society, right? But what's interesting is students and faculties alike are wanting to see more and more mobile applications for their learning. So they want to see access to assignments, access to online quizzes, access to textbooks, all in a mobile environment. So what we're seeing, and I wouldn't, some of it's being driven digital, some of it's being driven mobile. Okay, it's the whole notion of mobile as well that's driving this. So again, those are just some top line results from those few research studies, just to give you a flavor of some of the things that we do from a research perspective to remove friction. But now let's get into the meat of this, which is standards and best practices. So this is what BISG is best known for, is our work on standards and best practices. And let's start with our content structure committee. We are organized in committee structures. We have 9 standing committees. And I'll go through highlights from not all of them, but some of them. And some of the work we're doing where we would like to see more people get engaged. And I'm happy to answer questions about any of these. Stop me as we go. And if there are committee members in the room who can answer questions as well, because you know a lot more of the nitty-gritty of this stuff than we do on the staff sometimes, we'd like to hear from you as well. But let's start with EPUB. So one of the most important tasks of our content structure committee, which deals with EPUB and best practices around EPUB, is something that we call the EPUB grid. And the purpose of the grid is to show how the various features of EPUB 3 have been implemented by the various reading platforms, reading systems, right? So the chart looks like that. Hopefully you can all read that. Don't worry, it's actually really, really well organized and really easy to read, and it kind of looks like this. Each row shows a different EPUB feature. Each column shows an e-reading platform, including each known iteration of that platform. For example, we have the Kindle e-reader, the Kindle Fire, the Kindle app. Not every platform at this point has been willing to share information about their implementation of EPUB 3, so there will be some blank cells where we don't have data. The most important thing to note about this document is that it is a fluid, living document that will be updated frequently. But the folks who have seen it so far have been really pleased with it. If you are, it is downloadable for free on the BISG website. Go to BISG.org. I believe there's a link right off the front page. Look for the EPUB grid, and you can get this. And we encourage you to look at it. How many folks here are publishers? And how many folks from the retail side? And how many folks other? Digital companies, data aggregators? Okay. It's really valuable to pretty much any place along the supply chain here. You can see an example here of VitalSource, who's doing a lot of EPUB 3 implementation. They were one of the leading spots here. But what we've seen is implementation is really uneven. It's very uneven. And there's a lot of folks who are moving fast to get there, but it's still going to be a little while before this rolls out fully. And this is one of the things our committee did was to help with the aid of the staff, with Karen Foster and Angela Bolin, our staff, was to put this grid together for consumption, and again, it will be continually updated. The other work of the content structure committee, they have working groups that are dealing with fixed layout, font, and iAuthor, and they will each publish, each of those working groups will publish a best practices document around this. I think fixed layout is targeted first, and we expect that to be sometime in the next couple of months. So again, check the BISG website and sign up for the BISG Bulletin. It's just our free newsletter, and we kind of announce when these things are coming out. And what these are documents that will help you in your implementation guides as well, whether it's on the creator side, the publisher, or the consumer-facing side. It's all going to be of value. Anybody here on our content structure committee? Anything to add? No? Okay. Thank you. We have an identification committee that deals with product identifiers at every level. It's a very busy and a very engaged group, and represents really every corner of the industry. It is maybe one of our broadest representations is on this committee. The work that the committee did recently was to create our policy statement on best practices for identifying digital products. We published this probably about 6 months ago now, and it has been a really interesting process to see how this is rolled out. These are the key findings from this study. Some of these are really obvious, or you would think they're obvious, but remember, we have a lot of new entrants into the market. You know, as you look at some of the self-published numbers and folks are getting into this market, there are things they don't understand, right? ISBNs are are assigned, not created. There is no such thing as an ISBN. That's, you would think that's fairly obvious if you've been in the industry and you're working with this stuff, but it's not to everybody. So identifying these things is a really important thing to do for the industry, and getting buy-in is really important as well. A digital book should never be identified with a number that is the same format as an ISBN or labeled ISBN unless that number is assigned by a registering agency. So the use of ISBN here is really important. Digital books and print books should not have the same ISBN. Different format books, EPUB versus PDF, or different usage rights, rental versus sale, should not have the same ISBN. And if somebody's going to ask, what about EPUB 2 and EPUB 3? It's a really good question. We're going to... our identification committee is going to look at this again in July and see if this needs an updating or clarification now that it's been in the ecosystem for several months and we've gotten some feedback. Our identification committee will, which is chaired by Richard Stark of BNN, will take this up again. And then, not wanting to be a little bit without controversy, digital books should not carry different ISBNs when it's the same format, but... being sold into a different platform. And what we mean by that is an Adobe DRM book versus a different DRM book. If it's the same exact format and same exact book, our paper recommends that they not carry different ISBNs. And the reason is that the DRM is applied transactionally. It's a wrapper put on at the point of sale. It's not inherent to the product. It's inherent to the transaction. This raised a lot of questions both here and abroad, and it was something our committee thought long and hard about, and this is where the recommendation came down. Next, another chart that it's fine that you can't read. Anybody want to guess what a WLID is? Yeah, I'm sorry, please.
I'm sorry, say one more time. Mobi and EPUB
would be different formats. I think that would require an ISBN. But if it was EPUB, Adobe versus Nook's implementation of EPUB or Nook's wrapper around EPUB, that would be the recommendation would be the same ISBN. So I believe that we were considering Mobi a distinct format. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. Yes. The thinking behind that was partly what's in practice in the industry right now. A lot of this came from, again, you know, the U.S. market is kind of a couple of years ahead of other parts of the world, and a lot of this is derived from what current publisher practices were, what seemed to be working well. But again, the thinking behind it is transaction. Right. We're saying if the format is different, you want a different ISBN for each. Yes, that's what the policy statement says.
What is the thinking behind that?
The thinking behind that is that the format is both from the consumer facing thing, that it's just not used by the same devices, and it's to help inform the consumer of a different, identify it as a different product, because at the product level, a PDF and an EPUB are fundamentally different products. That's the thinking behind it. Whereas an EPUB with two different wrappers is the same product with a transactional wrapper around it. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
Okay. And by the way, when I said was not without controversy, I mean clearly that was a point of controversy. So, yes. Oh, here's the chair of our identification committee. Hi, Phil. Sorry. Did everybody in the back hear that? Okay. And that's thank you, Phil. And I did misspeak. Richard Stark is the chair of our metadata committee. Phil Maddens is the chair of our identification committee. Sorry, Phil. And thank you. Any other questions about this? And again, we encourage you to participate in the identification committee. The group will take this issue up again in July. Right now, we're looking at WLIDs. It's a work level identifier. And don't worry that you can't read that there. This is still in its very nascent state in terms of the committee. But what the committee is doing is identifying different use cases for a work level identifier, whether it's to aid in search and discovery, aid in understanding rights, tie editions together inside a publishing house. What we found is that publishers, by and large, are using proprietary identifiers internally to relate works together. And sometimes that proprietary identifier is the first published format. So if a hardcover is the first published format, sometimes that's a proprietary identifier that they're using internally. Sometimes they use a different identifier. Retailers and consumer-facing companies are wanting identifiers to cross publishers. And what we're seeing are a variety of use cases. And what the committee is doing now is going through the process of understanding what the use cases are to understand what the need is. There are existing identifiers out there. There's the ISTC, International Standard Text Code Identifier. There's the a Digital Object Identifier. And the committee is going to look at all of the options and determine, one, does the industry need one? Do we need to really think about a best practice or a standard here? Is there one that exists that we can adopt and then go from there? And that's the work of one of the things the committee is doing now. The other thing, I don't have a slide, but the committee will take up the newly the new ISO standard, the International Standard Name Identifier, which identifies not an author but a public name. So Mickey Mouse can have an ISNI, and I think Richard Bachman and Stephen King would have two different ISNIs, if I'm correct. So we need to take that up as well. And that will be a little further down the road, the work of the committee. That's a newly announced standard. Any questions about identification? Okay. Next, the metadata committee, which is chaired by Richard Stark of Barnes & Noble. Metadata has been one of the areas where we've seen tremendous friction in the industry. It's like a bad game of telephone. You all played telephone when you were a little kid. You know, I start here, I whisper something in your ear, you whisper it in her ear, and by the time we get to the back of the room, it bears no resemblance to what I originally set up here. Metadata is like a game of telephone. As metadata goes into the supply chain, it gets changed and altered along the way. And one of the things that we've done is we started a research project, or just concluding a research project, to understand the flow of that metadata in the industry, to understand where the transfer points were, to understand what fields are getting updated and not updated. On June 12th, we will have a webcast revealing results from that study. We will publish results both in an executive summary and in a full report. And then in July, we're going to be announcing another event to further get to those results. What we did is we contracted with Brian O'Leary at Magellan Media Consulting. He interviewed actually more than 30 companies. We did a survey of the entire BISG membership about metadata practices. We are in the process now of tracking metadata, test data through the supply chain to see how it illustrates where the transfer points are and how it meshes back with the interview and survey results. We did reveal some preliminary results at our Making Information Pay conference. Some of those findings were not surprising. And in fact, a lot of the findings were not surprising, but it's to see them all together, which is interesting. And then this will inform the work of our metadata committee, who has already published two documents, best practices for metadata senders and best practices for metadata recipients. And what we're in the process of doing now is updating those documents. This research will inform that. But some of the high-level findings, publishers obviously are concerned that their data is being changed without their knowledge. Recipients are reporting in bad metadata being received. Right? So what we need here, part of what we have here is a communication problem. And how can we strengthen that communication problem? There are still separate feeds for physical and digital products. Onyx 3 has really been very, very slow to be adopted at this point. Editor, who manages the Onyx standard, is sunsetting Onyx 2.1 in 2014. So I think we're going to see an acceleration toward Onyx 3, which does allow for a lot more data about digital products, and we're hoping to see some of those forks, some of those files that to come back together. And to have publishers sending one file with both P and E in it. Metadata is added to improve discovery and purchase, which is another thing, which is really great, but it's not often not reported back up the supply chain to the original metadata creator. So again, there are communication issues about metadata. And there's a great study by Nielsen, which will be also as a part of that webcast I mentioned, is a series of webcasts, three sessions beginning June 12th. The second one, I believe, is Nielsen's study about how metadata impacts sales. And if you haven't seen that presentation before, I urge you to look at it. It is staggering to understand how much more potent sales can be when there is good, rich data about the product. You would think, like, oh, duh. But if you look at the results of metadata, somebody's not saying, oh, duh, someplace. So these are the issues that we're going to be grappling with on our metadata committee as the results of the research. You can get a much more fulsome look at this and much with a lot of recommendations as well on the webcast. Oh, key recommendations here, too. First was to move the book in hand check upstream, to have the publishers actually check the book against the data. Confirm shared vocabulary. Our best practices document says very specifically what page count should be, but there's varying interpretations of what it should be. Retailers use it for one reason. Publishers use it for a very different reason. And again, better communication overall. Our metadata committee also oversees our product data certification program. We actually have a separate panel of industry experts who are on the metadata committee that certify sender data. So a publisher sends their data into BISG, and this panel certifies the data meets a certain minimum standard. Our colleagues at BIC in the UK, they do this as well. And our colleagues at BookNet Canada in Toronto do this as well. And it's really valuable. There are vendors or data recipients, rather, like Ingram, who give incentives for good, clean data. And we think more and more companies will do that because it really streamlines their work and their systems to not have to go back and rework data. We're in the process of looking at retooling this project to make it more scalable, adding some automation and working with some other vendors. And we intend to relaunch that in September. So that is metadata. Any questions about metadata? Who here thinks metadata is a point of friction in the book industry? Good. Not good that it is, but good that you acknowledge it. We have one of our oldest committees, used to be called the BISAC committee, is our subject codes committee. That is not them, but when I did a search for images on BISAC, there's apparently a BISAC badminton team. Maybe that is the committee, and I don't realize it, and when they're done playing badminton, they decide on, you know, post-apocalyptic versus apocalyptic as a subject code. I don't know. But this is one of the best things that we're known for, is the creation and maintenance of the BISAC subject codes. It's a very important thing for the industry. It shows up in all kinds of places. Publishers put subject codes in their Onyx feeds. Retailers augment them. It's a repeatable field in Onyx, so there can be more than one. There are conversations now going on about creating global schemes around subject codes. BISG is involved in those conversations. We also need to be thinking about online taxonomies as well, which may be a separate conversation. These subject codes were really developed for use in shelving books. And what we need to be thinking now are how do we categorize things and how do we aid in search and discovery where people are searching in a different way. Or not in a different way, because they're still finding books on shelves, but they're also finding books in other ways as well. But it's a very important thing that we do, and that committee is very active. They meet, every other month very regularly, and they update the codes every year. And our colleagues in the UK have their own scheme called the BIC codes, and we do a mapping between the two. But again, there's some conversations about figuring out how to get down to one. We have a manufacturing and distribution committee. This was a merger of our manufacturing executives interest group and our distribution executives interest group. The issue they're tackling right now is RFID. And this is much more obviously for physical books, but the insertion of tags to track an individual unit rather than an ISBN that tracks a title. I'm presuming everybody's familiar with RFID. No, a couple of no's. Radio frequency ID tag is a little, tiny little paper-thin chip you put on a book, and that identifies that specific unit of that specific title. And where it aids in is inventory management and in controlling shrink as well, both on the retail side and on the warehouse side. Where this is being adopted in the industry is in higher ed publishers for textbooks. And one of the things they're most interested in is stopping counterfeit books coming back from overseas. So they can identify if the book didn't have an RFID tag, they know it wasn't one of theirs. It also helps with returns. It has not been adopted at the retail level yet. It's something that's been talked about for a long time. There was a test store and I want to say the Netherlands that had been completely outfitted with RFID, and they were managing inventory, and they knew where every book in the store was at any moment, and they knew when one was leaving the store or not. And it's pretty interesting stuff. A couple of years ago, we were thinking this was much further down the road than it is, but our manufacturing and distribution committee is now tackling this issue. We've also, coming actually out of our distribution executives committee before the merger of those two committees, was our paper on sale date compliance. There are a lot of different terms in the industry. I come from a retail background. Street date, strict street date, lay down date, on sale date, and they mean different things to different people. One of the roles that a standards making organization can play is to bring clarity to that. This paper does an excellent job of that. This is also available for download on the website. And this really matters. You know, when you're trying to control an asset with a very strict release date, you want to make sure that all of your partners understand the terminology. This is a definitional issue. We have a rights committee because the world is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Everyone knows that's the Disney ride. It's a small ride. Okay. And what that committee is working on right now is creating standardized language for communicating information about rights and royalty transactions, first domestically and then internationally. And we're winding down our working group that is creating a spec to be shared between trading partners about rights and royalty transactions, because there is no standardization there. And it is it's a big hot mess. And if we can help bring some clarity to that, that will really save folks some money and some efficiency. And our rights committee is, again, it's a pretty diverse group, but we're always looking for additional voices there as well. And then, of course, we have these three guys. And what do they have in common? They're all pirates, right? But the pirate we're concerned about is Timmy. And piracy is no small issue. Illicit file sharing is no small issue, and it's something the industry needs to better understand. At the same time, efforts to lock it down can sometimes create barriers to consumption. So we have this push-pull between illicit file sharing and encryption. And at what point does the encryption get in the consumer's way, and at what point does it not? BISG is just preparing to release an RFP to study the size and scope of illicit file sharing and to get a better handle on it. We're not there yet, we're not promising anything yet, but that's a project that's just, again, in its very nascent stage that we're looking at right now. Let me stop there, because I only have two other slides really about our education, but let me stop there and ask if there are questions about that at this point. Yes? Any work on standardizing DRM? Not from the Book Industry Study Group. BISG is not taking up the issue of DRM. I think what we're seeing is probably the need for research first to understand what the problem, to define the problem, understand it. That would be for us a first step for the way we're organized and the way we work. I'm no comment. Any other questions? The last piece of what we do is education and events. So we take all that research, we take all that work we do with standards and best practices, and we disseminate information. And we do it in a number of ways. We do it through conferences. How many folks were at Making Information Pay this year? Well, I encourage you to look at the program for next year. It is exactly what it sounds like. It's a little different than some of the other conferences in the sense that it is really about data and how to make data work for you. It's a very data-driven conference. And this year, it was the subject was big data. And we had a good half-day conference that went really well. We do a flavor of Making Information Pay for the higher ed space, which is something we do in the winter. I'll come back to Digital Show and Tell in a minute. We speak at other industry conferences about all of these issues, and we're happy to always come and talk about these issues. And then we do webcasts. And this is really, I think, the best way we can deliver information. We just did a great series of webcasts in partnership with DBW. My colleague Angela at BISG ran them from our end. She really runs all of our webcasts on EPUB 3. It was a really well-attended, well-received group of webcasts. As I mentioned, we have one upcoming on metadata, which is starts June 12th, which I think is a Tuesday, and then it's three successive Tuesdays. You can sign up now for that. We encourage you to do that. The first session, again, will be the results of our research study. The second session will be the Nielsen results, and the last one will be Graham Bell from Editor on Onyx 3.0. So we encourage you to look at that. And then we are planning one farther out into the future on rights, and then, of course, we will have them from time to time on our various research results. Just briefly, Digital Show and Tell. That is something that we're doing here. This is, I think, the third. I think we've done one in New York City and one in Frankfurt, and we're doing it again here. It is a speed dating style event where really interesting book industry tech startups come and present their product in a very short window. I think it's 5 minutes to an audience of however people are in the room. And we have 9 stations going at once, and the people will move from station to station to station every 5 minutes or so, and then we'll switch and a different 9 come in, and we have a total of 18, and each group will vote for the best, and I think we'll probably do a best in show vote, so we'll do a best in show vote for all of it. There are still tickets available, not many, but there's still tickets available. It's right over here in 1E12 Thursday morning from 9 to noon. We'll have coffee. There's a $25 registration fee. You can do this through the BISG website. So we hope to see you there. And then that really brings us to the end of the circle and the end of the presentation. I will only just say again, what we do is help remove friction from the industry. We can't remove friction from the industry without, one, knowing what it is, which we need to know from you, and two, without your participation to understand how best to parse it. So I would encourage you to get involved. Talk to me, talk to Angela, talk to members of our executive committee, Ken Michaels, Dominique Rocca, and we'd like to see you participate. And with that, I say, if there's no questions, I say thank you.